Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak up. Kōrerotia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Ko Sally Carlton aho, te kai kōrero o te hōtaka reo irirangi, speak up, kōrerotia. While most of our shows consist of a panel discussion between experts on a particular human rights issue, people with lived experience, those who work with and alongside them, academics, researchers, advocates, this show adopts a style which we've only done a few times before. It is comprised of short commentaries self-recorded by members of the public and submitted to the show. This style opens up to anyone the possibility of publicly sharing their perspectives and enables us to hear a range of voices on any given subject. The kōpapa of this show is the Legislation Definition of Woman and Man Amendment Bill, which passed its first reading in Parliament in May 2026 and is now open for public submission. The bill proposes to define across all New Zealand legislation woman as an adult human biological female and man as an adult human biological male. The core arguments for the bill, as set out by New Zealand First's Jenny Marcroft, the MP whose name is attached to the bill, are that, firstly, these definitions would provide greater clarity and consistency in terms of law. Secondly, they would strengthen women's rights, which would play out particularly in terms of women's safety and sports, by reducing the likelihood of women competing against transgender athletes. And thirdly, that biological ideas of woman and man are, I quote, common sense and reality rather than ideology or identity. These arguments largely stem from Marcroft's positioning of the rights of transgender communities, particularly transgender women, as opposed to or incompatible with the rights of women, by which she means cis women or women who identify with the sex they were assigned at birth. This argument suggests that, as we work towards improving the rights of people who do not fit neatly into the definitions of woman and man, whether they identify as transgender, non-binary, intersex, gender fluid, or anything else, challenges and erodes the rights of women. We now turn to the 20 contributions submitted to Speak Up Kōrerotia, all of which present arguments in opposition to the bill. You will notice contributions from women, men, transgender whānau, folk from the wider queer community, older people, younger people, parents, academics, advocates, activists, all speaking from places of professional and or personal concern. While some similar arguments are repeated by different people, the show follows this rough structure. It starts by setting out some important definitions, then moves into reflections on why the bill is being proposed now and what this shows us about global politics in 2026. It then presents contributions setting out arguments about sport, the law, science and health, human rights and identity, before concluding with two longer contributions, which, between them, provide a poignant summary of most of the core arguments, both high-level and personal, raised by others in the show, and remind us why this bill should alarm not only transgender communities, but all of us.
Human rights relating to sex and gender can be a bit of a confusing topic, so it's helpful to start by establishing that when we discuss sex and gender, there are multiple spectrums which shape how people move through the world in this space.
Sexual orientation is who one finds attractive, if anybody, physically and or romantically.
Sex characteristics are a mixture of physical and medical factors, including external genitalia, internal reproductive organs, chromosomes, and how various hormones affect your body. When a baby's born, they're assigned as male or female based on external genitalia, and sometimes also their hormones and chromosomes. It's worth remembering that there are all sorts of healthy, naturally occurring variations in all those spaces, even amongst people who fit into the binary categories of male or female. Intersex people, who don't fall clearly into either category, also make up about 2% of the population. It's roughly 164 million worldwide.
Gender identity is which gender people identify with, if any. If that's different from the sex label they were given at birth, they are described as transgender. Somebody who is cisgender is somebody whose gender identity matches their assigned at birth sex. Non-binary people may identify with no gender, or more than one gender, or have a fluctuating gender identity.
And gender expression is how we perform the social norms, roles, and behaviours which are associated with the specific gender. Speaking patterns, clothing, hair and accessories, body language, profession, hobbies, etc. Which genders these social characteristics are associated with can vary wildly across cultures and across the course of history.
Every individual combines these various spectrums in unique ways, and their community's response to that will shape the person's access to power, resources, safety, and equitable enjoyment of rights. This is intersectionality, which means our access to human rights is affected by overlapping and interconnected layers of discrimination, harassment, or privilege arising from the various social categories that are applied to us, including sex, gender, economic class, ethnicity, disability status, and more.
A lot of the anti-trans legislation currently being passed in various places around the world has a tendency to muddle together the various different spectrums involved in gender and sexuality, as do the campaigns of most anti-trans organisations. This tends to happen because people are basing their campaign positions not on medical science or on listening to the trans and intersex communities, but instead on political ideologies, religious beliefs, ignorance, or even fear. That model definitely contributes to the ways transphobia negatively affects not just trans people, but everybody else as well.
The United Nations Declaration of Human Rights firmly recognises that all human rights are interdependent. Because human rights are so interlinked, reducing protections for human rights in one part of our community will frequently lead to negative impacts on human rights for another part of society. We are seeing this happen right now when it comes to transphobia and its negative knock-on effects for women's welfare in particular.
Kia ora. My name is Mohan Dutta. I'm a professor of communication at Massey University, and I direct the Centre for Culture-Centred Approach to Research and Evaluation, or CARE. For over a decade, I have studied how the far right organises across borders, the Trump ecosystem, and the culture wars that travel with it. I want to speak to one question. Why is this bill being proposed now? The answer, I argue, is not in Wellington. It begins outside Aotearoa. Much of my work traces how far-right organizing has been mainstreamed. What once sat at the violent margins has been pulled into the center of electoral politics, and through politics, it is written into policy. Movements manufacture a panic, parties carry it into parliament, and parliament turns it into law. The definitions bill sits at the end of that pipeline. It is panic made into policy. Let me say plainly what I mean by the far right. I mean a political formation that fuses ethno-nationalism with neoliberal capital, that polices bodies and borders, that manufactures enemies to consolidate power. The far right does not solve the cost of living crisis. It cannot. So it offers a different story. It tells you your insecurity comes from trans people, from migrants, from Muslims, from communities at the margins, and from the woke, from professors like me, from activists and advocates, from students who stand in solidarity with these marginalized communities. The structures of extraction stay untouched. The enemy is always someone with less power than you. Look to the United States. Scholars now describe Trump's second term through the language of authoritarian populism and fascism, of dystopia written into government. And the enemy chosen again and again is the transgender community. The legal record of his first term documents a deliberate crusade, from the military ban to stripping of healthcare protections. That missionary returned, decreeing that there are only two sexes fixed at conception. This targeting is not a local accident. It is coordinated, carried across borders, through think tanks, funded networks, and the digital platforms where outrage is the product and the source of profiteering. New Zealand First did not invent this bill, it imported it. This is what I call communicative inversion. The powerful dress themselves as victims. The same government that says it is protecting women has halted every pay equity claim in the country, 33 of them, extinguished under urgency to save the crown money. They stripped the wages of nurses and carers and social workers, women's work undervalued for generations, then stand in the house and claim to defend women through a definition. Watch what the hands are doing while the mouth is talking. And here is what matters most for Aotearoa. This is a settler colonial move. The binary of woman and man, fixed by chromosome and anatomy, is a Western imposition carried here by colonization. Leonie Pihama and her colleagues in the Honour Project Aotearoa remind us that Takatapui have always held a place within Te Ao Māori and that colonization imposed the rigid binary and the shame that travelled with it. To write a colonial definition of sex into the foundation of New Zealand law is to deepen that violence and call it common sense. So when we are asked why now, here's my answer. Because the global far right needs a steady supply of enemies and trans communities have been chosen. Because a manufactured panic is cheaper than justice, is cheaper than the complex problems of deep inequalities, of working class marginalization, of climate change that we are experiencing globally. Because dividing us is the entire point. But we do not have to read into this script and re-inscribe it. We can refuse it and turn back toward each other. He tangata, he tangata, he tangata.
Hi, my name's Lottie Vinson. I'm the director of the Canterbury Workers Educational Association in Christchurch. The question I really want to put to people and get them to think about is, why now? It's what I keep coming back to when I think about this bill. I don't think it can be separated from the wider political trends that we're seeing sort of across the world. And in many countries, including our own, there's been a rise in political movements that are encouraging people to see each other as threats rather than neighbours. So, you know, instead of focusing on the issues that affect all of us, like housing, poverty, inequality, healthcare, cost of living, the future we want for our children and grandchildren, our attention is being directed to these small and often vulnerable groups. And I think, you know, we need to be really careful. You only just have to look not even that far back in history to see some incredibly dangerous examples of where this type of politics has been used and with disastrous effects. For me, I think human rights, they're not a limited resource. So, you know, protecting the rights of one group does not require taking rights away from another group. And I feel like a healthy society is one where we recognise both rights and responsibilities. It's where we look after each other. It's where we resist the attempts to divide people into competing camps, which is what we're being asked to do here. I'm concerned about the broader context here in Aotearoa. We're living through a time where, you know, things are getting harder and harder for families. We're seeing political attacks on Te Tiriti or Waitangi and the place and rights of Māori and the place of Te Reo in our public life. And to me, it's all connected. It's reflecting a politics that's trying to sort of wind back things that have been hardly fought for, a politics where we're being asked to pitch each other against one another. rather than trying to make the place better. So I don't believe that the biggest challenges facing New Zealand are going to be solved by arguing over the rights of small and vulnerable minority groups within New Zealand. And I feel like the New Zealand I want to live in is one where we focus less on who to blame and more on how we build a society where everyone belongs, where we uphold te tiriti and where everybody has the opportunity to flourish. Kia ora.
Kia ora, my name's Louise. I live in Otatahi, Christchurch, and I am a tutor in human biology and tertiary education. And my overall impression of this bill is that the whole thing seems somewhat unnecessary, probably quite ill-advised, and it actually makes me feel less proud to be a New Zealander, the fact that we're even having this kind of debate in 2026. While I am all for women's rights and improving safety for women, it doesn't seem to me that this is actually what this bill is about. To me, with my background in health science and human biology, my understanding is that gender and sex are not the same thing. So while biological sex is something that perhaps someone is born with, gender itself is a socially determined construct and something that is subject to change over time. If we look at nature, nature isn't quite as black and white or as dichotomous about gender as we have somehow become as human beings. And I feel that if someone doesn't identify as the gender that matches the sex they were born with, that they should have the basic human right to determine their own gender and live in this world under whatever feels right to them. I'm really worried that this bill, the main kind of driver behind it, is not about making things safer for women, but rather it's about one particular sector of society imposing its very black and white dichotomous view of what gender should be on an entire country. And to me, this just doesn't fit with the things that Aotearoa New Zealand stands for. I'm proud to live in a country that was the first to give women the vote and one of the first to legalise same-sex marriage. But I feel that this conversation is completely at odds with that tolerant and inclusive view of people being the most important thing. And I wonder whether this conversation does reflect the wider radicalisation of political views. And it's coming at a time where we are all living with so much uncertainty. And the human brain doesn't like uncertainty because it results in anxiety. And we're evolutionarily driven to try and reduce uncertainty, that I can see why some people might think that trying to define male and female in law helps to make things a bit black and white. But I think that comes from a place of fear rather than from an actual desire to make things safer for women. And to be honest, there are so many other more important conversations that I would hope our leaders were having in 2026 than this particular one. I feel that this is just taking time and resource away from discussing other more important topics such as the environmental crisis and artificial intelligence. We really don't need more opposition and division and othering at the moment. What we really need is mutual respect, openness to listen, and more tolerance and kindness. That's the kind of New Zealand that I want to live in.
Hi, I'm Sandra Gray, and I'm the president of the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions. Really concerned and heard from workers who are trans and non-binary about the impact of the definition of a man and woman bill and just how excluded completely undermined they feel. So that's why the Council of Trade Unions needs to be involved in these conversations.
Everybody just wants to be them. We all know that. And it's really harmful
when someone comes in over the top and says, you can't be you, you have to be this thing I define you to be. So I was really, really concerned, but also quite angry. I do think it's a set of ideals from a past time and generation, which was really actually harmful to all sorts of women in past generations as well. For me, they're not ideals for Aotearoa. They're not ideas that we want. We want to wrap our arms around people. We want to include people. We want people to be who they are. I think that's genuinely the values of Aotearoa right now. So this feels like a lurch backwards in a way that's unnecessary.
Kia ora koutou, ko Holly Thorpe, tōku ingoa. I'm a professor in the Division of Health at the University of Waikato, where I have studied for over 2 decades now the biocultural complexities of gender and how that shapes our everyday lives and our workplaces and our homes and our experiences of health and well-being and sport and our communities. This proposed amendment bill with the definitions of man and woman is based on very outdated ways of thinking about biological sex as simply a binary between male and female. Research has moved so far from this towards thinking about gender as a social construction that is biological, social, and cultural. And this amendment bill overlooks that entirely. It has the potential to do significant harm to so many across our communities. It directly challenges basic human rights for people to exist, to have safety and a sense of belonging in our society. If this bill goes through, there'll be so many across our communities, our trans, our non-binary, those who do not exist within this very limited biological ways of thinking about sex. We have made so much progress over the last 20 years for gender and sport, making sport a more inclusive space for all. A lot of work has been done to create opportunities for everyone to enjoy the health and well-being benefits of participating in sport. Trans participation in sport really is a storm in a teacup. There are just a very few number of elite trans athletes, and they are not winning medals. They are not a threat to women's safety or opportunities in sport. This has been a topic that's been incredibly politicised, and it's been used, weaponised, to justify these very biological ways of thinking about sex that we are seeing coming through in the amendments bill. And I think we need to be really wary of how the topic of trans participation in sport is being used to fuel people's fear, their panic, their worries. There are many real challenges for women's participation in sport, but let me assure you, trans participation in sport is not one of them. And we should be asking really critical questions about why and who is using this topic to fuel this moral panic about trans people in our society. We need to be asking really critical questions about where this has come from, why now. This is part of a wider geopolitical movement that is travelling around the world. It is taking shape and having an impact here in New Zealand now, and we must stand up against this because of the harm that it will do to so many, both now and in future generations.
My name is Annick Massolo. I'm a professor of law at the University of Canterbury. I have a lot of objection to this bill, but here I'm just only going to talk a little bit about the legal perspective. I think generally this bill is likely to create legal uncertainty, inconsistency, and practical difficulty across the New Zealand legal system. The bill seeks to impose one single definition of a woman and a man for the purpose of all New Zealand legislation. So every time a legislation will talk about a woman or a man, the legislation should be interpreted as meaning a woman is an adult human biological female. So this is a little bit difficult because there is in our legal system some legislation which already contains well-established framework which recognize the complexity of sex and gender. Some legislation are gender neutral, they apply to everyone, but some of them, they apply specifically to women or to men. And some of them allows for gender diversity. So in this case, we have the possibility for New Zealanders to change legally and lawfully the way their sex and gender has been recorded on their birth certificate. And this bill creates some uncertainty about what will happen to those people and their birth certificate, which has been amended, changed legally under the existing law. Similarly, passports and driver license in New Zealand permits self-selected gender markers. So what will happen if this bill is adopted and passed? Equally, Stat New Zealand distinguishes between sex, gender, and variation of sex characteristics. So this is what it uses for its standards. So for example, when Stat New Zealand records the gender pay gap, it looks at the pay that women receive on average and the pay that men receive on average. And it takes into account also these various characteristics. What will happen if the gender pay gap then now includes some people who look like men but are counted as women? A lot of the gender pay gap is based on gender, the way people look and behave. And so it's not going to be a true account of the gender pay gap. And this will create difficulty in terms of actually doing a reduction of the gender pay gap. The bill does not reconcile this existing legal framework. In fact, it creates conflict with them. So it leaves a lot of questions unanswered about how government agencies are meant to deal with these contradictory records and how service providers such as hospital healthcare are expected to implement the law consistently. The likely result is that it's going to be creating some administrative confusion and it will create complaints. Unnecessary complaints, I would say, and those complaints will be costly litigation for the government, the taxpayer, but also for individuals. And, you know, as we know, the tribunals and the courts are already quite clogged up. The bill also creates legal uncertainty in other areas of laws. It defines a woman as an adult human biological female, and the Age of Majority Act 1970 defines an adult as somebody who has reached the age of 20 or older. In New Zealand law, we have the age of majority at 18, but we still have this idea of an adult being 20. And these questions about who is a woman and the definition that links woman to their age creates another layer of difficulty because it also makes it uncertain about who is a woman. So are people under the age of 20 able to be a woman, or are only people who are over the age of 20 able to be a woman? So this is particularly difficult and troubling in relation to the Contraception, Sterilization and Abortion Act. The bill could create uncertainty about whether a woman who is under the age of 20, whether she could continue to be covered by the provision relating to, for example, access to abortion services, which is healthcare. In matters as significant as reproductive health care, the law should provide clarity and certainty. It should not create some ambiguities. The bill also appears inconsistent with the principle underpinning the Human Rights Act. In 2024, the Law Commission's report was really clear that intersex, trans and non-binary people faced significant discrimination, and it recommended strengthening legal protection. This bill removed their existence, and therefore it moves totally in another direction. In conclusion, I should say that, if nothing else, in terms of law, this bill does not meet the standard of clear, coherent, and workable law in practice. Good law should solve problems, not create them. Rather than addressing an unidentified legal deficiency, this bill risks creating confusion, undermining existing rights protection, and generating uncertainty throughout the legal system. From a legal perspective, it is a very deficient piece of proposed legislation.
Tēnā tātou katoa, ko Megan Clayton ho. As a board member of Qtopia, I tautoko our organisation's condemnation of the passing of the Legislation Definitions of Woman and Man Amendment Bill at its first reading in Parliament. Qtopia stands with other rainbow, queer and community organisations in Aotearoa in opposing this bill. In a statement on our website at qtopia.org.nz, Qtopia sets out how the bill is based on disinformation, including a misinterpretation of the protections which already exist under the Human Rights Act for cisgender women and organisations that serve them. Moreover, the bill ignores the 2025 call from the Law Commission, Ia Tangata, for changes to the Act to better protect transgender and intersex people. It is these members of our communities who will be most harmed by the bill, which draws on outdated ideas about binary biological sex no longer supported in research. The Select Committee process that follows the first reading of the bill will provide a platform for harmful debate based on flawed premises. Transgender and intersex whānau in Aotearoa deserve better than this. What should Parliament do instead? Stop the bill and implement the 2025 recommendations of the Law Commission to improve protections in the Human Rights Act for the people against whom this bill discriminates, transgender people and those with innate variations of sex characteristics. Kia ora.
Hi, my name's Amanda. I live in Christchurch. I work in the construction industry and I have two school-aged kids. One thing that jumps out at me about this debate is that New Zealand First presents the bill as a defence of science and biological reality, but then some of the arguments that they use to support it are not scientific arguments at all. When Jenny Marcroft talks about Adam and Eve or says that people have known what men and women are since the dawn of time, this reveals that the motivations are ideological and not scientific. While I agree that a majority of people do fit relatively neatly into one of two categories, the definition excludes a significant portion of people whose biology has never fitted perfectly into a rigid binary, such as intersex people who are born with variations of chromosomes, hormones, and anatomy. They've existed throughout human history. Likewise, transgender people are not a new phenomenon. Historical records from many cultures show that people whose gender identity differs from the sex they were assigned at birth have existed for centuries. It's not a new thing. I believe that science should inform public policy, but if you're going to invoke science, then you should at least be honest about what the science actually says. Science does not support the claim that every human being fits neatly into two distinct biological categories. Human biology is real, but it is also diverse and sometimes complicated.
Kia ora, my name is Sarah Filoche and I'm head of obstetrics and gynaecology at Otago Whakaihi Waka, ki te whanganui atara. The aspect that I'm going to talk to concerning the bill is about cultural safety
and inclusive health professional education and how this underpins equitable outcomes for trans whānau. To make clear, current health outcomes for trans whānau are not equitable, here or overseas. I'm lucky enough to be part of Warming the Whare, and this is how I'm contextualising cultural safety and inclusive health professional education. Warming the Whare is a participatory action research project implementing trans inclusion across two perinatal mental health services in Aotearoa. Between us, our research and clinical expertise encompasses Māori health, midwifery, primary healthcare, obstetrics and gynaecology, lactation consultancy, violence prevention, community leadership, public health, and psychology. Warming the Whare centres Te Whare Takatāpui, which was created by Takatāpui scholar Dr. Elizabeth Kerikeri and is an Indigenous Māori model of well-being. It features six values: whakapapa, genealogy, wairua, spirituality, Māori, life spark, mana, authority and self-determination, tapu, sacredness of body and mind, and tikanga, rules and protocols, representing the different parts of a whare nui. When these values are interwoven, Te Whare Takatāpui can shelter and nurture all people with diverse genders, sexualities, and innate variations of sex characteristics, and their whānau. The deployment of rigid binary sex and gender norms in the bill are precisely part of the harmful legacy of colonisation that precipitates the need for cultural safety and healthcare in the first place. In Dr. Elizabeth Kerikeri's framework, Te Whare Takatāpui, we are reminded that restrictive binary norms about sex and gender deployed in the bill are not universal to human existence and do not stem from the beginning of human history. Rather, they were imported by European and British colonists and embedded in the legislative, religious and social structures of settler colonial states such as Australia and Aotearoa. These normative binary modes of sex and gender have been used as a core apparatus in the oppression of Indigenous people through colonisation. These normative binary modes of sex and gender are how healthcare professionals are taught in training. Medical education, for example, bases its authority on empirical evidence, objective scientific facts, and constructs people's bodies as results of biological processes and determinations. This training perpetuates exclusion from healthcare and inequity in health outcomes for trans whānau. So when we think about access to knowledgeable and skilled perinatal care, it is a human right and a cornerstone of health equity. Health professionals, organisations, accrediting bodies all recognise this through commitments to and expectations of cultural safety. For example, cultural safety is an expectation in the standards for medical school accreditation as set by the Australian Medical Council. Internationally and nationally, there is work underway to decolonise medical curricula, which includes recognition that biological essentialism, the fixed binary, is not only harmful, it's factually incorrect. So the proposed bill, if passed, directly opposes cultural safety expectations and initiatives to decolonise health professional education. Our concern relating to this is that this bill may in fact derail them. If you would like to read more about Te Whare Takatāpui and Warming the Whare, you can check it out on an open access journal, International Journal of Transgender Health, under the title Warming the Whare, an Indigenous Knowledge-Centred Guideline for Trans Health Justice and Perinatal Care, which was published in 2025. Kia ora.
Kia ora koutou. My name is Isis Mackay and I'm the General Manager at Women's Health Action. As a national organisation working across the full spectrum of women's health, our role is to listen, to really listen, to the voices of women, gender diverse communities and their whānau. Our work is grounded in what people tell us are the real barriers and enablers shaping their health and well-being. And while the issues raised with us are diverse and wide-ranging, the need for legislation to define the terms woman or man is not among them. It is simply not a priority. It is not something our organisation or the communities we work alongside have called for. What we do hear consistently is concern about safety, about well-being and inequity. But the reality is, women and whānau in our communities are generally not experiencing violence in spaces such as public toilets, changing rooms, or sports fields. They are most likely to experience violence in their own homes from people they know. In Aotearoa, we have persistently high rates of domestic and sexual violence. One in three women will experience abuse in their lifetime, most often at the hands of cis men. These are urgent issues facing our communities, and this bill does nothing to address them. Women's Health Action was established in 1984, and we have a long and proud history of advocating for women's health rights in Aotearoa. Our founders published an article called An Unfortunate Experiment, which helped expose unethical practices in cervical cancer treatment and ultimately led to the Cartwright Inquiry and subsequent report, a watershed moment that transformed patient rights here and internationally. Out of that came a patient-centred health system and a code of rights that give patients real protection under the law, a global first. This is a legacy we are incredibly proud of. And if we are to remain on the right side of history, we must continue that work. We must uphold the rights of all people to live free from discrimination and harm. We do not support the proposed definitions of man and woman bill. We see no benefit in legislation that risks creating division and exclusion rather than improving health outcomes and well-being, because human rights are for everyone. We cannot pick and choose whose rights matter. At Women's Health Action, we remain committed to advancing equity, dignity, and health for all communities. Kia ora.
Kia ora tātou. My name is Finn. I work as a registered nurse in an Auckland community mental health crisis team specialising in supporting people who are experiencing acute mental distress. I am disturbed by the proposed Definitions of Woman and Man Amendment Bill, which would legally invalidate the identities of thousands of gender-diverse New Zealanders and contribute significant psychological distress to rainbow communities. In my nursing work, I've witnessed the disproportionate burden of psychological distress, loneliness, self-harm, and suicide that gender-diverse communities bear. I've witnessed this pain and felt the ripples of unimaginable loss felt by those left behind. The 2022 Counting Ourselves National Survey of Trans and Non-Binary People reflects massive disparities in the health and well-being of gender-diverse peoples compared to the general New Zealand population. Gender-diverse New Zealanders are almost 12 times more likely to report very high psychological distress compared to the general New Zealand population. 53% of gender-diverse participants had seriously considered suicide in the previous 12 months, and 1 in 10 had made an attempt. Respondents are quoted throughout and speak of the harmful personal impacts of invalidation, discrimination, and hostility that they endure, both socially and through interactions with healthcare and public services. This distress is not an unavoidable consequence of being gender diverse, nor is gender diversity a mental illness. Rather, this distress is a direct result of invalidation, discrimination, and identity erasure. Identity and safety are fundamental to well-being. By systematically and legally invalidating and erasing the identities of thousands of gender-diverse individuals, the proposed Definitions of Woman and Man Bill threatens to further entrench existing and outrageous health and well-being disparities that are harming gender-diverse New Zealanders. I strongly urge listeners to urgently submit against this proposed bill. In a world currently mired by division, let us stand together and embrace the diversity of our shared humanity. Thank you.
Hello, I'm a 35-year-old self-employed female, originally from Japan, but have been living in New Zealand for the past 30 years. I'm a mother of two children, one non-binary teenager and one rather gender-typical daughter. I'd like to share my feelings about the bill. As a mother of non-binary child, we have spent the last 5 years discussing gender a lot. It started with my then-son wanting to wear skirts and ribbons, which we had no problem with. We thought it was just an influence of his little sister starting to wear more variety of clothing other than baby rompers. Then he started saying that he wanted to become a girl. This was the start of our long discussion and questioning what it means to change gender, why he wanted to become a girl, and how he felt in his own body. It was a long, ongoing discussion over years, and now we saw things change in that time with puberty as well. We have settled with non-binary as it describes what suited them the best at this stage, as we slowly figured out the issue was clothing and activities that were gender divided, such as haka performance, sports, toilets, and changing rooms that they did not feel comfortable in either male or female category. The society has become a lot kinder to gender-neutral children, and support the school provided was beyond my expectations. There has been an increasing number of like-minded peers every year, and it's good to see the rapidly changing unisex facilities in public spaces. However, I have talked to them about the fact that being born as a male still plays an important role in the legal side of their life. Like when they travel overseas, they will be stated male in the passport, and it needs to be stated in medical emergencies to receive appropriate treatment. In my opinion, it does not need to change. Whatever you decide to become, you do not need to change who you were before. It is also part of you. As much as they have the right to be accepted in society, they need to be aware of others who choose to become more gender-specific, and that is also their right. It doesn't mean excluding the gender minorities. I believe true diversity means accepting all needs and rights.
Kia ora, my name's Nate, and I'm the Gender Diverse Lead at Women's Health Action here in Aotearoa. A little bit about me, I'm gender diverse and identify gender fluid. I was biologically born a female and have two biological children of my own. I also live at the top of New Zealand in a small rural community and grew up in a low decile, low income area. A lot of the work I do with Women's Health Action is in regards to advocacy for whānau, whānau takatāpui, whānau in the rainbow community, and whānau in general in regards to general health. Now, I'm no expert on history, nor am I an expert in parliamentary proceedings at all, but I want to give my kōrero in regards to this topic. Obviously, being a gender diverse person myself, I support the fact that this amendment bill should be heavily, heavily reduced or just thrown out altogether, but that is only my own personal opinion. And I wanted to talk about why I feel that way. Growing up, I was never told about being gender diverse. It wasn't a conversation anyone talked about. And if you were a little bit more of a boy than a girl, as a female, you are classed as a tomboy. So obviously, I assumed that role. I assumed the role of being a tomboy for quite a lot of my childhood, but I never felt like I belonged anywhere. I never felt like I was a girl. I never felt like I was a boy. I never felt like I was a tomboy. And it was really confusing. But when puberty hit and all of the extra hormones got involved, it absolutely crushed my world, not knowing where I fit in society or even in the group that I was in. Mentally and emotionally, I went through it, and I can't even explain how much undoing I've had to do as an adult because of it. Regardless, we learned a lot about rights in history class at school, specifically rights in history in regards to American history for some reason. Don't ask me why. But we learned about it nonetheless. And what we learned is that women's rights were something that had to be fought for and had been fought for years. 134 years ago, women were granted the right to vote, and the rights of women started to appear more in Aotearoa's history. That is a stark difference to the introduction of trans rights, where the first discussions were only about 18 years ago, when they introduced the Rights Amendment Act to include gender identity as something to be protected against discrimination. 18 years ago versus the first introduction of women's rights 134 years ago. And we are not even talking about men's rights at all. There has been a lot of scientific advancements in the last 20 years, and specifically in the last 10 years. The technological advancements we have now compared to those years ago is absolutely astronomical. And the evidence that we have found in regards to gender diversity is insane, to put it in the most general language I can. We now know that gender is not a binary thing. People don't fit into just a man or woman box. And so why should our rights be taken away when we have substantial scientific evidence, emotional evidence, community evidence, historical evidence that this is not a binary situation for gender? The bill suggests that if trans rights are supported and this bill doesn't go ahead, it is directly impacting on women's rights. This, of course, is not scientifically backed by anything except for the fact that they've had this belief system in place for years. It's no coincidence that it's happening at the same time as Pride Month, which has been something very, very difficult to create a safe space for rainbow takatāpui whānau to celebrate ourselves. Supporting trans rights is not a direct way of not supporting women's rights. It's silly to say something like that specifically for someone who is gender diverse like I am, because I sit in both realms. I sit in feeling like I'm a woman sometimes and feeling like I'm a man sometimes and feeling like I'm in between sometimes. And so saying that supporting my rights as a trans person, as somebody who is diverse in my gender, doesn't support some part of my gender is a little interesting, if you ask me. A lot of the argument as well in regards to this man-woman amendment bill is that they are trying to support the natural rhythm of things for people to stay naturally aligned with how we are supposed to be. But that is incorrect because we are not a binary species. We have always been gender diverse, and it wasn't until things were introduced years and years ago to create this binary that things have changed. Creating rights for one group is not an attack on another group. It is just creating rights for that group. And it is literally creating rights for humans in general. We can all have rights to live freely and safely if we just continue to progress in that direction. But we can't progress in that direction if this amendment bill was passed. I urge you, if you have something to add, please do to this conversation, because right now it might not seem so urgent, but if this passes, then they will be able to pass a lot more laws without even consulting the public. So please, if you have something to say, to share with this kōrero and continue this, put your submissions in, anything else that will be helpful, we urge you to do so. Thank you so much.
So I think the problem with this bill is that it's taking a nuanced and complex discussion, which for some reason has been politicized over the last few years, and it's trying to simplify it. And this oversimplification is not beneficial for anyone. And I don't buy the argument that it's somehow keeping women safe. I think it's actually really detrimental. And as soon as you try and state in law what a biological woman and a biological man are, then we expect to somehow be able to see that binary way of talking about things reflected in society. That's really difficult for women. How do you know? How are we going to police that? My daughter is growing up. She's learning at school. She's learning through her social group. She's learning through my friends that you can be what you want to be. So you can be born one way and you can know that actually you are a girl, even though you were born and your sex was
decided as a boy and vice versa. And she knows that you can be they, them. And she's having this modeled to her at the moment by some amazing people. And I worry for them. And I also worry for her that this is detrimental to her, that she has to choose and she has to say, I am one thing or the other, because for a long time she hasn't been. She didn't want us to call her she. She was very against being termed as a girl for a really long time, basically until we told her that she didn't have to be. She can be neither or both, or sometimes she might feel like she's a girl and other times she might feel like she's a boy. And I'm so grateful that she's growing up like that. And I asked her about this bill. I tried to explain it to her and she just said, it sounds so silly. People should just be able to say what they actually are. And I think that's right.
Kia ora, my name is Cassie Hartendorp and I'm the director for Action Station Aotearoa. I'm a cis queer woman and a proud member of the Takatāpui community. Our team at Action Station chose to host a petition called E Tū E Ki, They Don't Speak For Us, Block the Definition of Woman Bill. And the reason we did this was because we wanted to give an opportunity for cis women to stand in solidarity with trans women. Say, trans women are women. We stand together. We refuse to be divided. They don't speak for us. This bill is not in our name. On a personal note, I have a really strong history with trans women. When I was a young woman, disconnected and displaced from my whānau Māori, it was whakawahine and trans women who reconnected me back to te ao Māori. They taught me how to karanga, how to poi, how to be in the world as a wahine Māori. I feel really indebted towards that. They shaped my life for the better, and it didn't matter what their biology was. What mattered was their mana, their whakapapa, their Māori, their wairua. And there's heaps of cis women who are like me. We don't believe the lies and the cynical attempts to just grab votes by racking up hate and speaking or claiming to speak in our name as cis women. We know that trans people are not the problem. You know, that politicians who are driving hate and division are. So we've got over 22,000 cis women who have signed this petition, and we're here to say, block this bill. It's not us. Let trans people be. Let them live exactly as they want to live.
My name is Natalie. I am a Pākehā woman in my early 30s, and I'm living in Otatahi, Christchurch. If I think about the prospect of having my gender defined in legislation, that kind of gives me the ick. I feel fortunate to live in a society where I feel that I have ownership over my gender identity. Identifying as a woman is something that I choose to do, and I'm privileged here in Aotearoa to have that choice. Echoing some of the comments that Nicola Grigg made, I'm not really sure what the bill is trying to achieve in real terms. I don't feel that the existence of non-binary language threatens my womanhood. I myself belong to the rainbow community. I have short hair, and so when on occasion someone has asked me what my pronouns are, I've happily clarified for them and have ultimately respected them for asking. And so at the heart of this bill, I fear, is this intent to take away that freedom of expression of who we are as individuals. And what I really fear is that it just feeds this narrative of intolerance towards minority groups or anyone deemed different. Our trans and non-binary folk are part of the wider LGBT plus community, which are a humongous group of people whose rights are under threat if we give in to this binary thinking. I think the binary terms of this bill reject the fluidity of sex and gender. And this is a fluidity that we know to be true. I think we as a society are past debating that point. Instead, I think the bill lazily wants binary sex and gender to fit into existing structures, rather than us as a society accepting the challenge that we need to rethink our social structures to accommodate the progress that we're making in recognizing and accepting that sex and gender are not binary.
Kia ora, my name is Natty. I'm speaking entirely for myself. And I just have been thinking over the last month or so exactly how to articulate the reasons why I am saddened and concerned about the proposed amendment to Legislation Act 2019. 24 years ago, I gave birth to my first child, who was classified on her birth certificate as male, i.e. I gave birth to a boy. For the next 18 years, I had a child who had a gorgeous smile, chocolate brown eyes that sparkle, enthusiasm that sometimes gets out of hand, is anxious, is a high achiever. She has thick, luscious, dark brown hair. She can make you smile. She can make you laugh out loud. When she plays her guitar, you have to stop and listen. So what I don't understand is why the outer body of my child is so important, because to me, she is exactly the same as she was when she was born and growing up. There is no difference in her just because she now is officially female, because she is. Her birth certificate now states that she is a female. So does her passport. And when she walks down the street with me, I don't think anybody would have any idea that she wasn't female. And yet, again, does that really matter? Because she is who she is. She has not changed. But what the proposed amendment would do, which is what the Supreme Court ruling in the UK has done, is just make it harder for everybody who loves her and everybody who wants to look after her, which is the whole community, I would imagine. It would make it more difficult for them to do that. In 2021, she had appendicitis and she went into hospital and they were able to look after her beautifully because at that point, there was no need to classify her specifically and make sure she was in exactly the right place. And they just put her in a ward with a few other patients and she was looked after wonderfully. Came through it, not a problem. She has always used the disabled toilets because she is aware that being in a female space may be uncomfortable for such people. And then she said to me, she said, disabled people appear to have never had a gender because disabled toilets are not disabled female toilets or disabled male toilets. They are just disabled toilets. Lucky for her, because it means that she can always find a toilet that she needs to use. But again, the real emphasis is, does it really matter? Does it really matter what her outward appearance is in terms of looking after her? She is a beautiful person. She is caring. She is loving. She's going to make a big difference to the world. She is studying AI safety at university, and all she wants to do is make the world a safer place. And yet around her is this increasing narrative that somehow by being who she is dangerous for other people. My daughter is being told that she is potentially a danger to other people around her. And that, to me, is the most hurtful thing that has started to happen in the world, is that we have started to say that people who happen to feel differently inside to what their outward body says are being told that they are a problem, that they are dangerous potentially, that they can cause problems. That is what I don't understand. And therefore, I do not feel that there is any need for a specific classification anywhere in our legal system, other than she is a human.
Hey, everybody. Kia ora koutou katoa. My name is Anna, and I'm a volunteer activist with Amnesty International here in Ototahi, Christchurch. If you're not already familiar with Amnesty, we're a global non-profit organisation aiming to prevent and to respond to grave human rights abuses all around the world. I'm interested in how the rights of trans people interact with women's human rights, And the perspective I'm contributing here reflects my own opinions as a woman and as a human rights activist, but also pulls upon some of Amnesty's campaign guidelines in that space. So Jenny Marcroft from New Zealand First has apparently claimed that the discussion around trans rights is a one-sided debate, i.e. implying that only trans people have been able to have their say on this. And apparently she also claims that trans rights are being sought at the expense of women's human rights. So let's break this down a bit, shall we? Let's start with her claim that this is a one-sided debate where only trans people's voices are being heard. I'm going to specifically reference the situation in the UK here for four interrelated reasons. One is that the political debate over there has been particularly fierce, particularly widely publicised on these issues, and I think is having quite an impact here in New Zealand, as is, of course, what's happening in the States. Second one is, although we're no longer a British Dominion, New Zealand is still part of the Commonwealth, and our legal system does tend to take a lot of inspiration from that in the UK. As a result, thirdly, the Supreme Court judgment last year gives us a good example, I think, of what might happen here at home if we decided to head down that same route of attempting to legislate narrow definitions around sex and gender and restricting rights based on those. And finally, the UK is actually where Amnesty got its start and still has its global headquarters, in fact. So they have been able to compile some pretty in-depth research and published it recently around the public debate on trans rights and women's rights. It's focused on their own region, but I think it's got some interesting insights that could be relevant here as well. So let's have a wee squiz at that. Amnesty found that in the UK, the major national newspapers that they were looking at had been averaging 9 articles a day over the past 5 years about trans issues. That is an intense level of focus, and it is indeed vastly disproportionate to the actual number of local people who are trans. It's about 0.5%. However, those articles did not centre the voices and the stories of trans people in the vast majority of cases. Instead, overwhelmingly, they argued against trans people's human rights and persisted in associating them with controversy, conflict, and harm. So although the media coverage is one-sided, it is definitely not in the favour of trans people. That coverage also tended to include senior politicos, cultural influencers, a fairly explicit attempt to try and frame trans rights as a core social and political issue, even though the actual levels of public concern on this one just tend to be a lot more limited. Often people are just a lot more concerned about things like economic crisis, for example. So this is not happening by chance. It is an intentional political strategy, and we'll talk about that a bit more in a sec. Amnesty also found that in the UK, there are currently at least 50 organisations that are campaigning against trans rights. 47 out of those 50 were only founded within the past decade. That's pretty recent for an NGO. Just for contrast, Amnesty International started in 1961. Amnesty here in New Zealand started only a couple of years after that. So many of these transphobic pressure organisations are remarkably new. A lot of them are part of international networks of other like-minded agencies, so they're often relying on international funding from overseas. And many of them, Amnesty has found, don't just campaign against trans rights, they also campaign against women's rights. So that's women's equality, women's medical rights, women's freedoms, and so on. I will dive into that one in a bit more detail in a second too. So as you can probably tell, this unbalanced transphobic media coverage and political rhetoric, it's not happening organically, or it's not happening in a vacuum. Instead, what Amnesty is seeing is that it is just one small part of a wider, coordinated, well-resourced, growing global effort to try and shift politics in a more authoritarian direction. And that includes legally trying to redefine and narrowly constrain just whose human rights, whose bodies, and whose lives deserve to be respected and protected, and whose don't. So we're seeing this trend in the trans-focused legislation that's come out in India this year, in the UK last year. It's all part of a concerning wider trend of authoritarian moves, and also part of trying to split society into more and more narrowly defined and strictly controlled groups, a divide and conquer political strategy, if you will. And at the same time, what we're also seeing is many governments, including Australia, still refusing to include questions in their national census around sexuality and gender identity, which is part of just trying to obscure how diverse their communities actually are. And just with so many other areas of authoritarian policy, transphobic legislation is about trying to replace how people identify ourselves and how we express our own personal autonomy with state-mandated identities and state-restricted activities. It undermines the existing privacy protections in the anti-surveillance regulations for everybody, not just trans people, restricts young people's access to important information, criminalises both supporting and belonging to the rainbow community in many countries, and we've also noted that it tends to try and reinforce very colonial and post-colonial cultural ideas. For example, around sex and gender, that is frequently at the expense of Indigenous communities' ideas that may be less binary and rigid around these categories. For example, takatāpui, two-spirit, whā, whenua, etc. Let's move on now and talk about the second part of Jenny's statement, her claims that trans rights can only be won at the expense of women's rights. Politicians, especially right-wing politicians, really like to present human rights as a zero-sum game in this way, where one group can only win if another group loses. And that attempt to frame their transphobia as about protecting women is also an extremely common approach. However, that supposed incompatibility between trans rights and women's rights, it's just not factual. Real-life stats don't indicate that harm for women and girls arises from increased acceptance of trans people in sports, in public spaces, medical services, the armed forces, could go on. Instead, what Amnesty does see is politicians, including here in New Zealand, frequently trying to use this disproportionate focus on trans issues to distract their citizens from increasing authoritarian power grabs and to try and distract us from their failure to take positive action on issues that do actually affect women in negative ways. For example, pay equity, inadequate healthcare access, inadequate childcare funding, etc. As I mentioned briefly before, Amnesty has also confirmed that many of the organisations that campaign to remove trans people's rights are actively attempting to restrict women's rights as well. So this includes campaigning against pay equity, gender equality in the workplace, abortion care, access to birth control, the list goes on. And that pressure that they're trying to bring to bear is already having negative implications for health around the world. It has particular issues when it comes to legislative changes that have negative implications, for example, for anyone who cannot safely give birth, and also for all the women and girls around the world who are dependent on medications such as hormone blockers and birth control to manage severe, sometimes crippling chronic health conditions such as precocious puberty, endometriosis, PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. Yet another really classic example of how transphobia harms all women is the practice of transvestigating, i.e. trying to identify trans people in shared spaces or online in the public, deny how they identify themselves, bully them, and attempt to block their access to basic public services. In most cases, people who indulge in that aren't actually observing someone's external genitalia as such. Generally, what they're doing instead is they are judging various aspects of a person's gender expression, their clothing, their mannerisms, the ways that sex hormones affect their body, and so on. We should note those are all things that vary enormously across the human population, even in the complete absence of any medical intervention. So because this practice judges a huge range of unique individuals against a very limited and unscientific set of social stereotypes, and because it tries to police gender expression, as well as fashion and secondary sexual characteristics, what transvestigating actually leads to isn't just bullying and danger for trans people alone. Instead, what it results in is a ton of non-trans people also being harassed, bullied, even assaulted. All just because some bigots didn't like how they express their gender or their wearing or the ways in which hormones happen to affect their individual body. Basically, what we see is that legislation such as that recent UK Supreme Court ruling logically ends up in a context where all women are open to sexual harassment by strangers under the false guise of protecting their rights and trying to protect them from trans people. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised that that's the case. Transphobic legislation and efforts to limit women's human rights both arise from the same place. That is an authoritarian desire to try and control people's bodies and their individual choices. They're also both deeply rooted in patriarchy and misogyny, which can feel a little bit counterintuitive when it's put against their argument of protecting women. But it is worth noting just how much of this discussion always ends up centering around trans women. Honestly, I think sometimes their opponents seem to forget that trans men even exist. That rhetoric around protecting women is simply a mask for their oppressing both cis women and trans people at the same time. And it's a big problem, because those are communities that already have significantly more limited access to human rights all around the world. So let's summarise, shall we? Human rights are indeed closely interlinked with each other, yes, but they are mutually self-supporting and interlinked. So as a result of that, when you attack trans rights, you also that leads directly onto erosion of other human rights for other people, particularly for women, but also for the general populace when it comes to things like surveillance and privacy, for example. Transphobic legislation and the media critique that tries to sell it as protecting women, they're both part of this wider, very concerning global trend that Amnesty has been observing, which involves global authoritarianism and misogynistic legal changes. And all of that is being cynically used by politicians, including ours here in New Zealand, to try and distract us, both from their increasing attempts at power grabbing and also their lack of constructive action on issues that do negatively impact women. I would strongly encourage anyone who's listening to have a look at what Amnesty International and other reputable human rights organisations are publishing in this space. Also to try and learn more about the trans community through reputable voices again, and to try and be alert to increasing authoritarian moves by governments, not just overseas, but also by our government right here in New Zealand. Being accurately informed about this stuff, I think, is half of the battle. And who knows, you may find that it changes your mind on some things. Thanks very much for listening, and thanks for giving me a chance to speak.
My name is Gray. I'm a transgender woman. And how I feel about this bill, I am terrified. I live my life as a woman. People can't tell that I'm transgender. I will walk down the street and no one will bat an eyelid. I'll go and use the bathrooms, the changing rooms. I will be and exist in women's spaces and no one will think twice about me. And I don't think twice about anyone else. I go into those spaces to use them for my own safety and to do what's intended in those rooms, like getting changed or going to the bathroom, living my life. This bill is terrifying. I never thought this kind of rhetoric would come here, which was honestly kind of naive of me, I think. I have seen the kind of hateful rhetoric and bills and laws being passed overseas in the likes of the United States and the UK. And I had just hoped that this kind of bill and this kind of scapegoating of the trans community wouldn't be used here. This bill being debated is again pushing us as a marginalised minority to have to fight for our rights, fight for our existence, fight to be recognised and treated with the dignity that we deserve as human beings. Seeing politicians denouncing my lived experience, seeing politicians denounce my supposed biological sex is so scary. If this bill gets passed, I worry about what future bills will come into effect. I'm so worried about the kinds of bills that might come out, limiting my access to healthcare, limiting my access to hormone replacement therapy, which I need to live. It's beyond like just a simple affirmation. I need this healthcare in order to survive. I worry about what kind of discrimination will be forced upon all women if this bill gets passed. Because if people start becoming more emboldened through this bill to police women in the possibility that there might be a trans woman there, all women will suffer for that. If you are a cis woman who has short hair or possibly a strong jawline or slightly broad shoulders or anything that potentially gives slightly masculine features, there is real risk that you will be harassed, you will be targeted for potentially being transgender. And then let alone, like, what is this going to do for trans people? We already have such high rates of mental health struggles in this country. According to Counting Ourselves, a survey taken of trans people in New Zealand specifically, psychological distress is about 71%, which is enormous compared to 12% of the general population. We get targeted, we get harassed already as a community. All this bill does is just furthering that discrimination and furthering that marginalisation and legalising and encouraging the hate. As well, the intersex community, I worry about what will happen with them if this bill gets passed. There are 40 plus different variations of intersex conditions that we know of. 40 plus types of people who don't necessarily fit into this rigid gender binary of so-called biological sex. What's going to happen with them? What's going to happen to their healthcare access? What's going to happen to their societal treatment? This bill does nothing for women's safety. The rhetoric that we're hearing around biological males taking advantage is a myth. Men don't pretend to be transgender women in order to harm cisgender women. It doesn't happen. That kind of theoretical scenario is just that. If we're worried about attacks in bathrooms, a biological male, I've put in quotation marks, is not going to dress up as a woman to get into a woman's restroom. People who are intent on doing that kind of thing aren't going to be stopped by the social niceties of a female bathroom sign. You know? Let alone the fact that this bill, as it is currently, would deny abortion care for women and girls under 20. That is harmful. That is so, so harmful. I worry about women's safety if this passes. Gaining access to support spaces or women's only shelters and that kind of thing. If this bill passes and it starts to become more normalised to kick women out of spaces who don't look a certain way, that just enables women to be kept in unsafe situations, let alone trans women. And yes, this bill supposedly targets all male and female people, but the reality is that this bill sets out to endanger transgender women. Because at the core of it, this bill is about policing gender and identity. They see trans women as the threat. I am not a threat. I am a woman. I am trying to live my life. And this bill endangers me. This bill encourages people to discriminate and harass and potentially attack people like me. All I want to do is brush my teeth, pet my cats, go for walks with my wife on the weekend, and live my life. I will feel less safe. All women will feel less safe in a world where this bill is passed.
Well, there you have it. 20 contributions totaling an hour and a half of audio. The longest Speak Up Court Editor show to date. Presenting a range of arguments against the legislation, Definitions of Woman and Man Amendment Bill. Contributors underscored that thinking of sex as a male-female binary is outdated and spoke of the damage this bill will cause, particularly to transgender, intersex, non-binary, and other communities which already face harmful discrimination and marginalization, but also to cis women and others. As several of the contributors did, we at Speak Up Court Eritrea urge you to consider sharing your thoughts on this issue by submitting on the bill, open until the 2nd of July. There are guides online as to how you might go about doing this. Qtopia has a really useful page, for example. And there are also other ways you can raise your voice in opposition, such as through the Action Station campaign, Etu Eki, They Don't Speak For Us. Share this podcast with friends and whānau who are wondering what this debate is all about. Kia kaha e hoa mā, we're stronger together. Let's unite and build the Aotearoa that we want to see.